Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. Hello, my wonderful audience. We've been talking together for years now, you know. And don't forget my newest book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. It does something no other scientific, popular, or self-help book has done. And it's a combination of science, self-help, and popular, which is to give an understanding to why in evolution we developed guilt, shame, and anxiety, why the human being over 2 million years, starting as a little tiny biped climbing out of trees, developed these emotions. I think I've got the explanation laid out for you. It's even been through peer review in a couple of articles. So take a look at it. It really is changing lives, guilt, shame, and anxiety. I really hold dear giving better alternatives and better approaches. On Mad in America, my latest blog, breaking news about the Oregon shooter, has had over 13,000 views now. People really want to know what's going on. Well, the information flow has stopped dead in its tracks. It's all been cut off, as happens every single time. And as it was cut off, I just wrote this blog pointing out that the shooter himself on his Facebook talked about having 4 or 5 drugs, presumably psychiatric drugs, in a bottle that he took when he wanted to. And in this case, he was taking four of each in order to get a good night's sleep. And we also know that his mother is said to have taken him to a mental hospital when he didn't take his meds. And we know we have this same pattern over and over again of young men going through the psychiatric system. So the answer isn't psychiatry. The politicians may tell you that again and again, but it isn't. All these people go through psychiatry. And we'll never know whether he was on drugs at the time because they'll clamp down on the autopsy and toxicology information. My hope is some politician is going to grab this someday and pass a law in some of these states about the necessity of releasing that kind of information. Today, we have the antidote to feeling gloomy. My friend, Michael W. Corrigan. Michael is an EDD. He is a marvelous man, full of energy, full of righteousness, full of research, a great presenter, really one of the really rare tenured professors. I don't want to type him as that, but he's a tenured professor at Marshall University, one of the few who is out there using knowledge and information to defend people being abused by misknowledge and misinformation. His special area, children and ADHD, at least for me, that's his special area. He's got a number of special areas he'll tell you about today. You may have heard him before on the show. Believe me, it will always be fresh when you talk to Michael Corrigan. Are you there, Mike?
I am. How are you?
How am I? Gosh, after that stunning intro, I get a, how are you?
Well, I don't know how I topped that one. Felt like George Costanza and just saying, I'm out of here.
Well, you are. You're a fabulous presenter. He's also a graphic artist. I mean, he's a lot of different things. And he uses his own graphic art when he does his presentations. Of course, he's younger than me, and he's new generation and all that. I just get up there and talk. But he does a fabulous job with his videos. Michael, what are you doing now? What are you going to tell us about? I know you're on tour, for goodness sakes. What are you going to tell us about?
Yeah, we're well, we have a new movement called Reclaiming Childhood. We're doing a bunch of speaking engagements, a bunch of different cities over the next months. We've got 5 scheduled right now. We're in Albany, New York next weekend, and then we're in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in November 21st, and then we're down to Bowie State in the Baltimore, D.C. area on December 5th, and then we're down to Clearwater, Tampa Bay on the 12th of December, and then we're going to be at NYU in New York City on January 23rd, and booking all kinds of stuff and trying to get out west and cover more of the areas, but pretty fun. I just try to, hopefully you'll be joining us soon, but I just try to get as many people as I could that have inspired me when I'm out talking, doing talks and presentations, and got them all together. We got Robert Whitaker joining us, Dr. Marilyn Wedge. A lot of people might know her from her blog that went viral with the Why French Kids Don't Have ADHD, but she's a great therapist and author, and with Dr. Gretchen Lefevre Watson, who's done amazing work, Kevin Miller, a good friend of yours, Michael Gilbert, he's a New York School Psychologist of the Year, Dr. Robert Foltz, another clinical psychologist up in Chicago, and me, and some really inspiring parents that have some amazing stories to tell, like Richard and Kathy Fee. So Michael Gilbert and I put it together, and we just decided, let's put together an amazing cast of folks to share that other side of psychology and psychiatry, what we should know about helping kids.
Do you have a website that's going to have dates
We have a Facebook page. It's if you type in project and then the hashtag or number sign for the kids, FORTHEKIDS. We have that, and also you can go to Michael's organization's kind of running the show. So we've got his website is, if you Google It's About Childhood and Family, they'll find the website there.
Well, I wish you well. Most of those people are good friends of mine, and I think that's a really inspiring lineup. And I think, I really want to help you get the word out about this. And I think it's so worthwhile. How did it come about that you decided to do this? How are you financing it, if I may ask? Because this is a marvelous undertaking that you're doing.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I mean that in a good way. It actually started when I was presenting at the conference you put together in Albany last year. And I was sitting there, and I was just looking around, and I wrote a blog on it on Mad in America called The 800-Pound Gorilla in the Room or something. And I was just, like, looking around, and I'm like, I'm not the only 800-pound gorilla in the room here speaking the truth today. And there was just so many folks that inspired me that day. And then, along the way, met some more individuals. And I just thought, it's one thing for us to go out as individuals and do presentations and do a nice little hour-long talk or keynote for someone. But we're just like wetting the taste buds of those who come. So what I was trying to look for, what Michael and I were trying to do, was how can we get the best speakers together that can help a parent, help an educator, help a clinician leave with the knowledge they didn't have before, the truth, the evidence to show them that, drugs aren't the answer. In fact, there's tons of child development research. There's tons of research in therapy that shows, therapy is so much better than the drugs. And so we just tried to get everybody together that had a little piece of the pie to share with folks so we could provide one really good dessert for them. And, we've put it together where it's kind of organized during the day where, the beginning is here are the challenges, here are the issues. Here are the misleading facts, and then the latter part of the day is more positive information. Yeah, this is what we know, but here's what we can do. So there's a lot of good parenting advice, and there's a lot of good child development advice. And I try to make it fun. I don't want it to be boring. I don't want people to get bored and start looking at their phones while I'm talking. So we've tried to get the most inspiring speakers in there to just really light the place up and bring down the roof.
Well, they're going to be great, great, great conferences. I'm trying to think of, you know, just keep us in touch, because I do want to broadcast where you're being and, you know, and who's coming to your conferences. I think it's a marvelous idea. I just hope you fill those rooms with people. What do you think's happening out in the world now with ADHD and the drugs? We've got so many people being critical of it. My sense is that while the world's learning more and more how bad it is, more and more kids are still getting put on the drugs.
Yeah, and I my wife's a therapist, a good one as well, and I interact with a lot of people. I'm still a college professor, so I run into folks all the time that want to ask me about why I think the way I do, whether they're in the college in my university or other universities I visit. But and then you just run into parents that just want to tell you the facts that they know because that's what they've been told and that's what they read on the CHAD website or whatever, you know. And I'm always blown away by how many folks still believe that whole chemical imbalance theory, that, you know, my child suffers from a chemical imbalance. And it's like, you know, I ask, so, oh, did they do a test to figure that out? You know, with a smile on my face, I'm trying to be nice. And they're like, no, they just know it. I'm like, how did they know it? You know, and it's just the level of craziness going on. And I hate to misuse that term. I know it bothers some of my friends that are in mental health that I say crazy in that way. But it's absolutely idiotic to me that so many in the field have not taken the time to read the research that kind of just goes against what they might have been taught in their school, you know, where they went to, what they might have been told a decade or two ago, that what we know now is to be completely false. I loved Robert Whitaker's latest blog he wrote a few weeks back about the guy questioning why he was bringing it up, the chemical imbalance theory again, and then Robert just went in and showed how the DSM and the APA and all these different groups have admitted to it, you know, being a falsehood that they spread. So I don't know why they're still believing. I had a student recently decide to write their research, you know, paper that they had to do for my class on it, and they actually shared in there, you know, how this research was so good. And this, they quoted a 1982 study from some journal on how it helped academics. I'm like, did you read any of the research in, you know, 30 years after that, you know, because we've completely debunked that myth as well. So to me, I'm floored constantly by how we're still believing this stuff. I've started, you know, I have my book on debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids for Acting Like Kids. And I actually, you know, I have a YouTube channel called Debunking ADHD. And, you know, thanks to yours and Ginger's help, I'm sure I'm sharing it on your Facebook page. My latest video, the 7-minute ADHD diagnosis, just got over 10,000 views.
Wonderful.
It's getting some good traction. But what I've really been interested in recently, beyond the ADHD, is how many younger children, 0 to 5, are just being medicated for anxiety and depression and you know, all these other things. And it's like, you know, I teach child development. I try to explain to folks, you know, what's going on. But at the same time, I'm a parent who's raised children. And I'm like, so anxiety, depression, their ADHD, you know, these sound like three of the emotions and personalities that the average, you know, infant and toddler displays at 7 different times during the day. So which hour of the day are you actually drugging them for depression? And then which hour of the day are you drugging them for anxiety? Because that's the whole point. Aren't they developing trust at that point with their caretaker to help them learn how to handle anxiety? So how can we actually be diagnosing children, you know, under 5 years of age? I mean, we can move the age up to make it seem more ridiculous, but under 5, under 3, under 2 with anxiety. I mean, they're just learning how to handle, you know, those moments of anxiety. So I can't believe we're medicating kids for that. And, you know, that to me, it's just not ADHD anymore. I mean, when, you know, there's, you know, 6 million some kids diagnosed ADHD, 4.5 million are being drugged for it. but there's over 8.2 million kids, probably higher if than the stats are reporting, that are being drugged from, you know, 0 to 18 years of age for a whole handful of these common diagnoses we're giving that really, you know, for some of them, it might be a serious issue of depression. For some of them, they might be suffering from extreme anxiety and have gone through trauma or whatever to do it. But for the vast majority of these kids, it's not the issue, and we're passing them out like vitamins. And, you know, doctors are, you know, telling parents it's as safe as giving them aspirin, or, you know, it's just silly that this is still going on. And I just recently read an article by Gretchen Lefevre-Watson on why it's getting so bad on campus, on college campuses, with the kids abusing ADHD drugs. And she makes a good point in there. It's like the more drugs that we prescribe and more people have these prescriptions out and about, it contributes to more kids being able to buy that drug, you know, and not being prescribed that drug, to abuse that drug, to snort that drug, to take it just for studying, to grow addicted, like, you know, Richard Fee did. You know, it's just, to me, it's out of control. And I people ask me why I do it. I'm like, there's only a few of us out there screaming that it's got to stop. And, you know, and I try not to scream. I just try to talk. But I'm just always at a loss as to how folks like yourself and myself seem to be the outliers on this argument still, when it's still so obvious. I mean, if you just look at the common sense and evidence behind this, if you just look at how silly it is to use 18 common descriptions of every child you know to, you know, give them a mental disorder label. And that's why I wrote the book, you know. That's why I've jumped into this field. I mean, I still do a lot of evaluation work on federal grants and work with schools and, you know, different groups. But, I mean, to me, that's what I'm passionate about right now, is just trying to help folks understand it's just part of child development. Most of these behaviors we see are just part of child development, and we just got to give it time.
Yeah, and a lot of what I see in terms of the kids who actually come to my practice, which means well-meaning parents. Not all parents are so well-meaning, folks. I mean, there are twisted motivations driving some people. But when the kids really are having a problem, it's almost always simply a matter of the parents needing to develop better approaches to raising their kids. It's a child-rearing problem. Lo and behold, the child is out of control. We used to call it undisciplined. The great advantage of calling it undisciplined was we could view the child as needing discipline and of course, love. All kids need love, but they also need discipline. And a lot of parents have no idea, very well-meaning parents, how to go about just teaching their kids to be respectful and to handle situations with other kids and with teachers. That's a lot of what I see in my practice. I'm sure if I were in an inner city clinic or a clinic, you know, in the outer reaches of West Virginia, I'd be seeing a lot of kids from suffering from badly disrupted families as well. So it just depends on the circumstances you're working under, but it's never a disease called ADHD. It's always a child responding to their environment. It's so obvious.
Yeah, I agree. And I think structure is another key aspect there. Is, you know, they go through a pretty structured day during the school day, and then a lot of them come home to, like, not the type of structure they need to end that school day and have a little bit of fun, a little downtime, but still get that homework done and still get that quality time with parents and, you know, exercise and a little fresh air. So, you know, a lot of the efforts that we put in to helping folks, you know, is just helping them look at that structure. And it's not easy. I mean, you raise children. You and Ginger raise children. And, you know, I've raised children. So my wife went back full-time in January. I wrote a piece on it on Psychology Today on my page there. But it was like about, I think it was called Waving Joyfully and Sadly Goodbye, but it was about me walking my kids to the bus stop that first day of school, because She's working full-time. I get summers off, supposedly, for being a professor. And I said, well, I'll watch them. So we decided I was going to be, you know, I kind of took a heavier load throughout the winter and spring since she was much more busier. But then I decided to watch them this summer. And I had a rude awakening. If anybody wants a good laugh, they can read that blog. But I truly felt like Michael Keaton and Mr. Mom several occasions, where I was just like, the house was a disaster. The kids were arguing and chasing each other. You know, everything was out of control. And I'm like, wait, you're supposed to be an expert in child development and all this stuff. Like, you know, get a grip. But, you know, I definitely fell into the traps that so many parents do, where I was like, oh, this is a great movie. I love this movie. You guys should watch this movie. And then I could hear in the background, like, I shouldn't have my, you know, 7-year-old watching that movie. But he just makes silly mistakes. And at some point, this, you know, my we went on vacation midway through the summer, and my wife, I said, honey, I need help. You know, how can we make the rest of the summer work? Because I still needed to get work done, because I still have a lot of consulting work and research I want to write on and do analysis and everything. So I finally figured out, I realized that my son loves to get on the computer and do math games. You know, what the heck was I thinking? I could have had him doing a good hour of math games all summer long, you know. They actually enjoy studying when it's made fun. I wasn't getting any workouts in, and then I realized, hey, you know, let's go out. And I put together our own little soccer camp for several weeks, because both of my kids play soccer. So we went out and played soccer for an hour every day. And then we started doing, you know, exercise and going up to the reservoir and doing several miles of walking and running. And, you know, I realized, you know, I can do a lot of the things I'm doing that I want to do. And I can have my kids doing similar things at the same time, and we can all be productive, and then at the same time have a great time together. And I think we get so occupied with our work, we let it dictate who we are, what we are, and we miss out on the fact that our kids need us more, or just as much as, you know, our work's demanding.
That's surely true. Now, one of your emphases has been that a lot of what's going on is just developmental problems. Not the problems, it's just the developmental timeline that different children have.
Right.
And I would not see that so much, because by the time somebody comes to me, there's usually a lot more turmoil going on than that. So I think it might be really worthwhile for you to talk at some length just about this whole idea of developmental progress and how different kids are. And folks, we are, just to remind you, we're talking to Michael Corrigan. He's an educator and a tenured professor at Marshall University and a great presenter. If you ever want somebody to present at your conferences about ADHD. So talk some about your research on developmental issues.
Yeah, so I teach a lot. I'm a developmental educational psychologist, is my perspective. And, you know, I constantly teach different developmental theories. And you know, one of the theories that I'm sure a lot of educators and experts in mental health know about is, you know, Jean Piaget's theory of cognitive development. And it's a good theory, because it shows how kids gradually and sequentially develop. They go from one stage to the next stage to the next stage and to the next stage. And if you look at Piaget's cognitive, you know, development theory, I mean, you can find it online, just Google it. But you're going to see there's, you know, a stage called sensory motor, when it's like 0 to 2 years old, where they're just, you know, learning how to use their hands and toes and feet and and actually start to you know, create schemes and think about how to get from point A to point B, or how to get a cookie out of the jar without getting caught. And that's at, you know, it ends around 2, and then the next stage of, you know, begins, and that's that pre-operational stage, he calls it, and that emerges about 2. But what people don't realize is that could start happening early when they're still 1. At the same time, it could be happening later, like 4 or 5, you know. A lot of folks, I use it as an example, but, you know, Albert Einstein didn't start speaking until he was like 4 years old. And he threw, as the history on him says he threw temper tantrums constantly, like way above normal than any child, you know, until he was like 5 or 6. So imagine in today's world, if Albert Einstein was here, what would we have diagnosed him and put him on? And the next stage starts, you know, concrete operation starts around 6 or 7 years old. And they keep developing more and more skills on how to think more critically and how to behave and how to be able to handle those things. But the points I try to make to educators, especially because if I can just make a dent, I want it to be with this age group of 1 to 11, because that's what I find most astonishing. That's what set me on this path was when I was in an elementary school seeing so many kids drugged in the school I was working in. And what I try to point out to them is a lot of these kids are being diagnosed in these age groups that are right between these developmental stages. So they go to see these experts and they say, yeah, they seem to not, you know, be at the same developmental level or behavioral level as their peers. And when you look at that, you know, it's because, as I explained in my book, they might just be one stage or 1 year away from, you know, if we want our children to just be normal, they might be, you know, one stage away, one year away from catching up and being normal again. But what we're allowing so many of these experts that want to push the drugs on the kids and get paid by insurance companies and therefore have to provide a mental disorder code to get the insurance companies to pay is we're allowing them to diagnose normal developmental challenges, if not possibly a developmental delay, which are most often temporary, right? They're going to go away if you just give that structure, that love, that care, all that sensory those kids need to learn and develop. We're drugging these kids before we've allowed the natural development process to take its process or to have the kids get caught up on that development. And to me, when parents are thinking about it and they email me or contact me or you know, catch me at a conference or wherever, I just tell them, you know, that's fine. You've gone and seen them. It's fine. They're telling you the child is this. But, you know, if I were you, what I would do is just give it a year. And during that year, I would, you know, look up websites like Love and Logic or whatever parenting guru you want to find and just get help on how to parent better. I urge them to, you know, figure out how to fill their days with more activities that inspire the children and help them get a, you know, more universal view of how other people live and how we're supposed to behave. So there's just so many theories that back that up, that whole idea that some kids are going to develop fast when they're younger and slow down. Some kids are going to develop very slow and then speed up. You know, no child develops on the same level. So to some degree, we got to be aware of, you know, decades and decades of good quantitative research done in child development that doesn't exist. You know, you have research that documents these things I'm talking about. We don't have research that documents these drugs are going to help any of these kids beyond 2 to 4 weeks show less symptoms than they were having before because we just drug them to quit showing those symptoms, you know.
You mentioned a website, Love and Logic. How do people get to that?
Is through it my
Love
friends, and Dr. Logic? Jim and Charles Fay, they're great parenting trainers and got some really great stuff. I worked with them a little bit, and I did a study on their program a year or so ago, and I typically just go in and do evaluation work for, you know, schools and organizations that work with schools that are looking to collect evidence to show how they work, and that was one of the few clients that hired me. They flew me out to Orange County, where one of our consulting offices was, and they're like, just come out and see one of our seminars. And my consulting partner, Dr. Doug Grove, and I went to it, and we were both parents, and we sat down and we started listening, and we were like, this is good stuff. And we started looking around, and every parent in that place was just nodding their head and like, oh my God, it's this simple. What was I thinking? And it's just, you know, a really good common sense of, you know, delaying consequences, you know, showing and feeling real sincere empathy with the kids, being understanding, you know, and just helping kids to have these many lessons in life, you know, MINI, you know, these little lessons in life that help them to manage emotions and make good, you know, decisions as kids while we're with them, so they'll be able to do that when they're adults. Because, you know, that's what I'm seeing now at the university level. A lot of these kids that have been, you know, gone through the system of mental health and diagnosis, they're having issues at the higher level trying to, you know, exist on their own and make the right decisions and be organized, because they've been on medication so long and they've been kind of, you know, nurtured in a small childlike way throughout their whole life. They've never been given that independence to just go out and be themselves. And I can't tell you how many kids come to see me, you know, during my office hours and stuff, just to say, you know, I got off medication a year ago and I'm feeling so much better now. And some tell their parents, and some tell me they haven't told their parents. And I think that's what's really neat is, you know, we need to give them a chance to experience childhood, the joys of it and the not so joyful moments of it, because that's where we learn our life lessons.
I've been doing a lot of reading and thinking lately about evolution. You know, it's what led to my writing the Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety book and evolving a concept of the evolution of guilt, shame, and anxiety. And it's so clear that throughout probably a 2 million year development, from the time, maybe even three, from the earliest times that we can identify human-like creatures, they appear to be living in small groups based on family ties and then whoever else might get involved in the group. And these groups were sometimes just families surviving, maybe just a small family surviving in some wilderness area, because everything was wilderness, surviving in nature, not wilderness, in nature, and hunting and gathering. And as time went on, some of these groups got to be 30 or 40 people, but not rarely more than 30, 40, or 50 people. They were voluntary associations. They didn't have rulers, because there's no way to rule over a people that has 40 or 50 members, and everybody makes their own clothes, makes their own tools, and makes their own weapons. There's no way to rule over them. They're not dependent on a leader for anything, except to help them, you know, be a cohesive unit if they so choose. And that this went on from 2 to 3 million years ago through our development as Homo sapiens over several hundred thousand years, right up until it began to fall apart 10,000 years ago, when we started to live in villages because we became farmers and we began to domesticate animals. So we would live together and carry out farming and domestication. Whereas previously, over these millions of years, we've been nomadic and wandering and existing in these groups. And almost everybody who evaluates this said that we had more personal responsibility then, we had more freedom then, we had better nurturing. There's a lot of people thinking we had much better nurturing. Kids were nursed until they didn't want to nurse anymore, because, by golly, it was easier to carry around baby food in your body than to try to make baby food 200,000 years ago. So kids would nurse till 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever they were up for. And that relationships were very intimate, and people really learned to care about each other. But if you went hunting, you went hunting with a group because you wanted to. And if you didn't go, maybe you wouldn't get some of the deer meat, or maybe you would, or maybe you'd have to go out on your own and get some. But people took care of the infirm. They took care of the elderly. It wasn't ideal, obviously. But how we grew up is to be independent, responsible, quite free people, learning from our parents as children, learning from being in nature. And now we take everybody and we put them in a classroom all day long. It's just not how we evolved. We didn't evolve to be these little automatons. Does that make sense to you, Michael?
Oh, I completely agree. And I, to some degree, I think that's, you know, a lot of the issues we're running into. I'm one of the biggest supporters of educators out there. I have a book called Multidimensional Education. I've got a book called The Handbook of Pro-Social Education. And, I mean, I know how hard it is to teach. I taught kids in a juvenile detention center for a number of years. And it's hard to keep them interested for a long period of time. And at the college level, it's hard to keep them interested for 2 hours, let alone when you have if you teach in elementary and you have the same kids all day long, every day, and you've got the dynamics between those children in the classroom, you've got the dynamics between the teacher and the child, you've got the child wanting to be somewhere else, doing something else, you've got the teacher having to meet all these demands of the education policy and their administrators. And you know, the good teachers you meet out there know how to make the curriculum fun and interesting. They know how to keep the kids inspired and tuned in to what's going on. But it's a long day. I try to, you know, tell parents all the time, like, go just, if you don't believe how hard it is to behave in that class and pay attention all day long, just ask the teacher if you could just go sit in the back of the room all day long, right? And I've even asked teachers to do this. I said, you know, on a Saturday, just go in, record yourself for a whole day, and then put it up on the computer, and just go in all day on that Saturday and pay attention to yourself for 7 periods straight and see if you can do it, you know, and not fidget and not move around and not get angry. It's impossible. You can't do it, you know. And
We're meant to move. We're meant to move around. John Adams said, move or die, and that's who we are. We're inquisitive. We're curious. We want to think for ourselves. We want to look around. We want to taste stuff and touch stuff, and the whole.
Well, there's a reason why. I know in Ohio, where I live, I think it's the seventh or eighth largest school now in the state is the new online school that kids can do instead of going to school. So many kids have grown tired of the traditional model that we have, and the you know, standards-based approach that's going on. They're choosing to stay at home and take their classes online.
Do you know much more about that? Can you tell us about it?
Well,
ever go to school?
I'm not a great believer. I definitely don't want my children to do it. I like the social aspect of school. It's a social incubator,
Michael,
right?
It's
where they
learn
how to behave and think, and you know, that's really the biggest part of school.
That can be created differently, though, can it?
That
can be created differently than going to a school. I mean, there's homeschoolers all over the United States who have social lives they're creating outside of school.
Yeah, and some of them have great social networks, and it's just as much, you know, it's a lot of work. I've met a lot of homeschoolers that are doing a great job. I personally would never get any work done if my children were homeschooled. I learned that this summer.
But I think it's good for some kids
that are having challenges. Maybe they could do it for a year and go back into school. I think it's a great alternative. From the university level, I have concerns about it because I often wonder who's doing the coursework, who's taking the test. I can't be at every computer watching whoever's taking the test. We don't have that advanced of a system at Marshall. But, you know, they still need support, and I hear good things about this thing in Ohio that they're doing, but I don't know if every online school's providing the support the kids need to understand and what's going on. But I also know that in my school district, Common Core is being done pretty good where my kids go. It's being done pretty well. And that is they're flipping the classroom. I don't know if you've heard of that term. Have you ever heard about that?
I don't know what it means.
Well, instead of the kids coming to school and the teacher doing all the lecturing and teaching the lesson, a lot of the lessons are learned that my kids can come home and watch the lesson online in a short, really good, exciting format that doesn't take a whole period. And then that way, when they come to school, they're actually doing the homework and the activities in school. So my kids don't bring home a lot of homework these days. They actually got to go online and kind of learn some lessons. And then the homework they're really actually doing while they're in school as you know, small groups or as individuals or doing presentations and projects there to you know, strengthen the lesson, help them learn it a little better. So I know my son 2 years ago as a kindergartner just despised school and first and second grade, he just loves it. It's fun again for him, which really makes me happy because I know a lot of parents that their biggest challenge is their children hate going to school.
And this is called flipping school.
Flipping the classroom.
Flipping the classroom. And how much time do the kids spend on the computers learning that way
It varies from day to day, but it's a lot less time than years past. You know, my daughter's much older than my son. I just remember the homework being a lot longer. I remember the homework causing tears. I remember endless worksheets, you know, driving her crazy. And you know, kids love to get on a computer and check things out, right? And if they can get on a computer and not be looking at Instagram or whatever stupid stuff they do, you know, and actually get on a computer and do research and watch videos and learn, I think that's good stuff. And you know, I live in a district that's got the resources, so they're able to track the time the kids spend through like Schoology or PowerSchool or these different websites they have. So it's well organized. I know it took our district a year or two to really get used to Common Core, but I hear a lot of complaints about Common Core wherever I go. And typically when I hear those complaints, the things that correlate to that same school district are it's normally a lower income. The school district is not giving the resources to the teachers that they need. You know, they don't have folks helping them develop these resources to put online. The teachers are having to do everything. And I guess that's, I watched the Democratic debate yesterday. I guess that's where I definitely side with Bernie Sanders in that, you know, we need to fund education more. We need to give more money to do it right. And if you ever read any of my books on education, you'll realize I think standardized tests are about a worthless endeavor. You know, the Finland, the country that's blowing everybody away, they test their kids one time before they take the international test, the PISA test, to see how they're doing internationally. We test our kids three times a year, nearly every year, from third grade on, and it's just our kids are over-tested, and these teachers are being expected to learn a new curriculum, do all this new technology stuff, you know, flip their classes around, make it more interesting, get kids doing more critical thinking, and then meanwhile they have to give up weeks on end of instructional time just to prep and give time to do all this testing. And we're wasting billions of dollars on testing when we could be investing those billions of dollars on better staff, support staffs, you know, better, you know, more strong, you know, more people to be on the leadership teams to help support the teachers, you know, more technology. You know, we've got schools that are requiring kids to use computers and teachers to use computers and technology, but they don't have bandwidth in the school where everybody can actually be on the computer and the internet at the same time. So it's just, it's an underfunded, misguided, you know, policy approach, and that's why my colleagues at Fordham and Rutgers, we put the Handbook of Pro-Social Education together and asked about 100 people from around the world to contribute chapters, and what we put together is an education policy recommendation that focuses on the social side of development and focusing on providing a great climate and a caring environment for these kids to grow as human beings, you know, to develop the whole child, to educate the whole child. Because when we actually focus in the schools on helping the whole child develop, guess what happens to academics? It gets better. And right now, so many schools and classrooms are just being consumed by the academic side of education and the testing side.
One place, I don't know, we've never talked about these kind of issues, but we might differ, is this issue of funding. I mean, some of the worst school districts in the world, like Washington, D.C., are very, very heavily funded. But the bureaucracy and the regulation and the laziness of the teachers and the fact you can't fire anybody because of the unions, this is such a awful ball of wax that holds back the parts of our country that give us such a statistically poor representation. Usually, I think when we get compared to international standards, they're not actually entering in, you know, their poor urban populations into the the mix as we do when we give out our data. And these schools, I don't know that the funding is the issue. Where are you on school vouchers and setting up more of a free enterprise approach to schooling, which is one of the things that I'd like to see more of, so that parents could be choosing what looks best for your kids, what works best? What are your thoughts on that, Michael? I have no idea what your thoughts are.
I don't know about the vouchers program or the charter schools or creating schools that are better than other schools or allowing people to go to some specific school because, you know, it's supposed to be better or this or that. I do agree with you that the mismanagement of funds and the mismanagement of labor taking place is a bad thing. But, you know, a lot of people want to say there's already, you know, teachers are being paid too much or, you know, there's too many people working in schools. You know, if you go into most elementary schools today, you're going to find one principal, and they are the one manager of, like, one counselor, possibly part-time, and then you have, like, three to five teachers at every grade level. So you got pre-K through, and you got pre-K, K, and then first, second, you know, all the way through fifth or sixth. So you've got basically 28 teachers in there on average. You've got five staff. I try to make this example. Name one retail store you've walked into recently where one manager is in charge of 35 people on a daily basis, and they have to somehow manage those 35 people that are locked in a separate room that they can't even see. You know, we need more administrative support that can support the teachers and help those teachers that are struggling do better and find the teachers that are doing wonderful to help some of those struggling teachers. And yes, I agree. Find the teachers that are crappy, that are unmotivated, that aren't doing a darn thing, and give them a chance to learn how to do better. And then if not, they should be moving along. Tenure has caused a few issues. At the same time, I know I enjoy tenure as a professor because I feel I earned it, and I want to be able to share how I feel instead of having to jump through a hoop and be, you know, this person that passes out candy, popcorn, and chocolate every day because I get good evaluations. You know, at some point, you want teachers to be able to hold their students, you know, to the fire and push them to try to do harder. So, you know, the way we're actually evaluating teachers right now on these standardized achievement tests, those things haven't rose the scores haven't rose in 20 years that we've been tracking them. The reason they're not rising, right, in my opinion, is the tests measure IQ. It's mainly based on reading and math, right? What's your IQ score typically based on? Your mathematical and spatial abilities and your reading abilities. And we can't increase IQ significantly. More than one standard deviation over a lifetime, as the research says. So why do we expect teachers are going to raise this level of proficiency every year? And to me, I think we just need to find more inspiring teachers. Unfortunately, at being at the college level and trying to teach teachers, we don't necessarily get the best students on campus pursuing an education degree because the salaries are absolutely horrible for teachers going into the work world. And the demands are twice as heavy as any sales job. So there's a lot of flaws there. And I don't know if we should blame the teacher. I think it's just the system in general needs overhauled and revamped, and we just need to go back on focusing on developing great citizens for our community. And when we develop motivated and caring citizens in a community that figure out what they want to do in life, then they're going to work hard to figure out what education needs to provide for them to do that, and you're going to get better scores. If that's what everybody's worried about, that, you know, we're going to somehow no longer compete in the world because our education isn't producing as high as test scores. But our test scores go up when we focus on helping kids become better kids.
Why aren't you in favor of or kind of interested in that whole issue of giving more choice, more creativity, more free enterprise into the educational system?
I don't know. I haven't seen any major, you know, and I visit a lot of schools, so I haven't really seen any that make me feel that that's the best way to go. The other unfortunate part is if we're allowing some schools to benefit from that are doing that much better, that these kids want to leave the schools that aren't working or the parents want the kids to leave there, then we end up with the same problem we have right now. It's just, I don't think it fixes the whole problem. What we got to do is fix education across the board and help every school get better. And I'm not sure, yes, the voucher program will provide an opportunity for children to find a better school. But what the voucher program doesn't do is provide an opportunity for a better opportunity for those kids that are stuck in the school that the other kids left. So I grew up poor. I don't know if my mom could have found a better place for me to go. She might not have been one of those parents that did that. And I think every poor child deserves a great school. And I don't think just because these parents are paying to go to a rich, you know, private school or religious school, that they're getting that much better of an education than some of these public schools are doing. And I'm telling you what, there are low-income communities that have incredible teachers and principals providing an excellent education. So it, to me, it's not necessarily money, it's not location and all that. It's what the teachers are doing and who's driving the show and what they're trying to do together. And that's all I try to harp on and everything I write on in education. Let's just let teachers get back to inspiring youth to being great people. Let's quit worrying about academic proficiency and actually, you know, try to inspire them to be great
people.
I'm
certainly with you on everything. I think they're, except the larger political problem, the voucher programs are really intended for the poor in the inner city, because then they can go to alternatives that the public school has to compete with. And one of the hopes would be that as the system became richer with more and more varieties of schools, that the competition would increase, and then either the government schools, which is what they are, the government schools, would either improve or disappear and the system be replaced by free enterprise. I'm sure that there's some general political difference here in thinking, but I hate to let go of that, because especially for the inner city's children, I've been in those inner city schools and in D.C. and looked into the communities and all, and it's just a horror show, and almost any kind of alternative to those schools to get out of that bureaucracy, to get out of all those teachers.
Well, there's great charter schools coming in and developing those type of schools, and they're corporately ran, right? But the state or the federal government is still giving them money to have those better schools. So the point would be is if we're going to give the voucher to the kid to go to the better school that's newer and has the higher paid teachers and the better trained teachers, you know, why can't we just, instead of giving that money to a corporation, why can't we just come to the realization that our schools look like the penitentiaries of 40 years ago? They're nasty, they're outdated, they have no technology in them, and we're expecting public teachers who are getting paid half of what those charter school, or, you know, at least a third less of what those charter school teachers are getting paid, to do the same thing with so much less. So it's abandoned. If we're going to abandon a system and get rid of it, then fine, yeah, Let's give the money to the corporate and go. But that's a long process of watching public schools lose more and more students and more funding and get worse and worse. And not everybody's going to get to go to that voucher school. You know,
what about all the other kids that aren't going to get to go there? Like that is really needed, especially for the urban centers. You know, you compare them to prisons, and those are state-run. We could compare them to state mental hospitals. When the state takes on these huge endeavors, it doesn't produce free citizens who want to challenge and think and stand up for themselves. It produces members of the bureaucracy. We differ on this, but I did want to just offer that alternative.
I could be wrong. I say that at every talk I give.
Well, this is a very hard subject, but you brought up Bernie Sanders, so I couldn't resist taking the non-socialist position on it. Michael, we got only a few minutes left here. In fact, I don't even know if I've been warned yet to get nearer the end. You've got about a minute or two. Give us some just some general thoughts on what we're talking about.
When it comes to school, I just tell parents, urge parents all the time to just go talk to your teachers, connect with them, make them feel welcome to email you at any time or call you at any time if they have any concerns or if they have any thoughts on how you can help the child. And I tell parents all the time, you know, most teachers that you're ever going to meet, the last thing they want you to do is drug their kid to sit like a zombie in that classroom all day long. They'd rather figure out how to help that child holistically. And to me, if it's related to school and this whole mental health thing, is there are some wonderful teachers that care about every kid in that classroom equally. And I just urge parents to go out. And if you don't have a teacher that's that way, then go talk to the principal and say, I'd like another teacher in this grade. And if that principal doesn't, if the climate doesn't feel good in that school, then I'd go to the superintendent and say, is there a chance that I could drive my child to a different elementary school because I'm not happy with the what's going on there? You know, and I don't think you need a voucher to do that. I think you can just go and ask and just be polite and be caring and just tell them what you're really wanting to do and what you're trying to do at home to help them and what you're looking for in the education to help complement what you're doing.
Remind people how they can get in touch with you.
I have
Michael
a
Corrigan,
Facebook page, Debunking ADHD. I've got a YouTube page, Debunking ADHD, and I've got a blog site on Psychology Today, a blog site on Mad in America, and if you really wanted to email me, it's corrigan@marshall.edu. I don't have my own website. And if there's a web developer out there that'd like to create a website for me that for free, I'd be willing to take that.
You're doing such great work. It's amazing to me that with all your skills, you haven't made a website. I thought you'd have one of the best websites in town.
Well, I've got a website called core5afterschool.org, C-O-R-E-5, the number, and then afterschool.org. So I put a boatload of money into that one, and that's a free clearinghouse for parents and educators to figure out how to fill their day. I just don't have enough time to put anything on the website, you know, and I figure everybody can find me on Twitter, Facebook, or whatever.
Right. Tell me, you mentioned, just very quickly, we got about the 30 seconds, you mentioned Love and Logic, and can people find, as for
parents? Yeah, loveandlogic.com. Charles and Jim Fay, and they've got a YouTube channel, too. Just watch, you'll love Jim Fay, Peter, if you watch his video.
Any others?
One of the most entertaining performers.
I like Nurtured Heart Approach, Howie Glasser. People can look that up.
Very similar. Jim Fay's been around even longer. They started this in the 80s. So a lot of stuff you see in today's parenting things, I think, were complemented greatly by what Jim Fay and his folks started to do. So it's one of the best parenting things I've found to date.
Michael Corrigan, thank you so much for being on the show. And I'm sure we will be meeting somewhere at conferences. Michael W. Corrigan, thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you, Peter. Keep up great work.